through them.
I mean, I never attempted to touch your mother. Until after we was married.
Well after.
Oh, you are awful. But I like you.
Is that the door?
Yes.
Thank goodness for that.
Glass. Bottom glass.
This Basil's wife. This Basil. This smack on head.
Moony bold.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the show.
I'm David Mitchell, and here we are again with the third part of Radio 2's look at the history of British comedy and the people and characters we all know and love.
Unless your face is famous, they treat you just like any other twit.
On behalf of us other twits, may I say that it's one of the things that you come to learn to live with.
Well, I find it irritating that after a lifetime's dedicated service to two monarchs, people are still likely to confuse you with some muffin.
Sounds reasonable to me.
This time, we're going to look at what many have called the golden age of British comedy, the 1960s and 70s. It was a time of expansion on TV and radio, while the live circuit was driven by summer shows, pantomime, and working men's clubs. In our previous programme, we took the story up to the dawn of the 1960s and covered two game-changing comedy classics, Hancock's Half Hour and The Goon Show. Both of those shows ended in the early years of the decade, but something new was on the way, a Sunday afternoon radio show that would pull in an audience of 15 million listeners and take them round the horn.
Now, the answers to last week's quiz. Question one, complete these song titles. Well, the answer to question A, Give Me Thee, was, of course, The Moonlights, and not the Screaming Habdabs, as one of you wrote. Question B, Button Up Your. Well, of course, it was Overcoat, and I will definitely not accept any other suggestions.
The 1960s social upheavals, the pill, women's liberation, rock music, everything was signifying massive change in the air, and it was cultural as well as social.
Media lecturer C.P. Lee.
Sunday afternoons, round the horn, was an explosion of innuendo, which I think basically they got away with because those people who didn't understand it didn't understand it, and those who got it did.
It must have been that the BBC censors were unaware of the double entendre, what they heard, or the innuendo.
Round the horn fan, Dr. Jonathan Miller.
It just simply escaped their attention. There were hundreds of indirect references to gay behaviour, for example. I listen to replays of them now all the time, and I'm rather amazed that they got away with those innuendos and double entendres.
Hello, shop. Anyone there?
Hello, I'm Julian. This is my friend Sandy.
We've established that the British are obsessed with innuendo, but never in the field of comedy had anyone pushed things harder than Julian and Sandy did.
Excuse us being all covered in hair, but we've just been stripping a borzoi.
Well... that is it? Well, at least we thought it was a borzoi. When we stripped him, we found it was just a hairy whippet.
What can we do for you?
Well, actually, I'm looking for a pet.
Oh, yeah.
What Barry Took and Marty Feldman were doing there, because I said, you know, I don't think this will be popular. They said, yes, it'll grow, Ken, give it a chance, because what we're doing is to educate them, because we're going to say, all right, that hitherto it's been regarded as esoteric to go into a whole load of jargon, but we'll make these two outrageous characters.
Kenneth Williams.
Funny because of the manic insistence of the one making the other confess. So the one would say, well, I went in, Miss Strawn. And I said, yes, you went in, go on. Well, Miss Strawn, I went in, and he said, yes, what did he say? Go on, what did he say? Go on, tell him what he said. Well, he got hold of me, and he said, yes, go on, what did he say about your eyebrows? Well, he said, you could do with plucking. Yes, Miss Strawn. This other one kept pushing the other one into terrible confessions, you see. Which, I mean, they weren't really terrible at all when you actually work them out.
Well, it's not exactly what I had in mind. What about this little chap on the counter? He seems very quiet and well-behaved. A Yorkshire Terrier, isn't it?
Paul, there's a floor mop!
Oh, I thought he had a rather long tail.
Are you absolutely set on a dog?
Not really, no. I just wanted something out of the ordinary.
Yes, when it comes to innuendo, there was certainly an awful lot of it about in the 60s. Kenneth Williams was simultaneously keeping his end up on the silver screen with the phenomenal Carry On films.
Hello.
Everyone knows what is meant by the phrase carry on humour, which has become part of our language. But the films themselves developed over the next 20 years, reflecting the changing tastes of the audience. The first one, Carry On Sergeant, in the late 50s, was a warm tale of camaraderie and British pluck. As the films moved through the 60s, they became freer and laced with sexual innuendo. Donald McGill postcards brought to life, as people tend to imagine when they think of the genre. But by their demise in the late 70s, the double entendre was more forced and attempts to shock were creeping in.
You either like them or you don't. I mean, it's a waste of time walking through life avoiding smut or pretending you know nothing about it.
Carry On star Kenneth Connor speaking back in the 1990s.
I think in the day the Carry Ons were majorly popular because they were filling a gap that was left with the music halls closing down.
Writer of numerous books on British comedy, Robert Ross.
The whole sort of vaudeville tradition had gone from our variety theatres, and I think British people light jokes about bodily functions and sex and alcohol and going on holiday, and the carry-on team filled that gap, you know, for 20 years. And they touched topics like the army and the police and the, you know, the hospitals and that sort of stuff. So that's why they were popular then, and that's why they're also popular now, because they're not really satire. They're not Peter Cook and Dudley Moore or the Pythons. They're just being, you know, funny. And the topics they poked fun at have never really changed.
There is, of course, one carry-on moment that remains a part of British culture to this day. Here are Kenneth Williams and Barbara Windsor, remembering the circumstances behind the most famous bra removal in British history.
It was winter.
Oh, no,
and everyone was pretending it was summer.
Yes.
And the leaves are all falling off trees, and he glued them back on and sprayed them green.
That's
remember?
Right. And it was all mud. And
well, that's right. You were knee-deep.
Right, and I kept saying, your feet are sinking in the mud. They said, Barbara, if we were looking at your feet, we wouldn't be employing you.
That's
and
right.
All that was going on. And to get that bra off, do you remember? It's very hard. The ladies will know that. You can't do that and the bra come off like that. Anyway, you got this old boy. Do you remember? Anyway, they got this old boy with a fishing rod and a hook and stuck it there, you see. And of course, I was like, okay, la 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 la, okay, pull the rod. And every time he did that, it went, I used to fall flat in the mud, didn't I? And Jerry, the director, said, get her up, go on, dust her down.
Dust her down, try again, yeah.
And that was how it went. And it went for about 20 takes. Anyway, we finally got it, which was terrific, that. And then they left us all alone. Do you remember? They said, it's a wrap.
That's right, they left us. And you went on.
Did
you went right off. Because you said, look at me, my boobs are all covered in goose pimples.
Yeah,
I've got my feet half in mud.
I know.
So the producer comes and gets out of his Rolls Royce with his cashmere coat and his Wellington suit. Oh, carry on, girls. Then goes off for his champagne. He's got his arse in the marmalade.
But the social change of the 1960s wasn't all about bras. At the beginning of that new decade, a small show was knocked together to fill a few spare dates at the Edinburgh Festival. Like all Edinburgh shows, it thought it was going to change the world. This one actually did.
Good evening. I have recently been travelling round the world on your behalf and at your expense, visiting some of the chaps with whom I hope to be shaping your future. I went first to Germany, and there I spoke to the German Foreign Minister, Herr... And there, and we exchanged many frank words in our respective languages.
Beyond the Fringe changed everything from the concept of comedy review shows to the way people thought about the Prime Minister. And it launched the careers of four young Oxbridge graduates, Jonathan Miller, Alan Bennett, Dudley Moore and Peter Cook.
Dudley and Alan were at Oxford and vaguely knew each other. Jonathan had left Cambridge before I arrived, and somebody called John Bassett knew of us all and asked us to do an hour's show at the Edinburgh Festival after the Royal Shakespeare Company or something like that. And we all met and did this hour show. We all had our own little bits of our own and wrote some stuff together. And it was a complete accident. And suddenly we were doing Beyond the Fringe in the West End, then going off to Broadway. And it was pure accident.
I think the reason why Beyond the Fringe was, in some sense, a turning point,
Jonathan Miller,
was not because we brought about something which was revolutionary, but you have to remember, in a sense, that we were the expression of something which was happening at the time, because it was a post-war performance expressing a change, a massive change in sensibility, which occurred as a result of the war.
The show was called satirical and groundbreaking, but two of its participants claimed they were merely interested in trying to make people laugh.
Mr. Spigot?
Yes, Spigot by name, Spigot by nature.
Mr. Spigot, you are auditioning, are you not, for the part of Tarzan?
Right.
Now, Mr. Spigot, I couldn't help noticing, almost at once, now, you are a one-legged person.
You noticed that?
When you've been in the business as long as I have, Mr. Spigot, you get to notice these little things almost instinctively. Now, Mr. Spigot, you, a one-legged man, are applying for the role of Tarzan.
Right.
A role that traditionally involves the use of a two-legged actor.
True.
And yet you, a unidexter, are applying for the role.
Definitely.
A role for which two legs would seem to be the minimum requirement.
We of the four in Beyond the Fringe were the two who really enjoyed doing it. Jonathan was agonising a little bit about whether he should be a doctor. Alan at the time was wondering whether he should be a history don at Oxford. And Dudley and I just couldn't believe our luck. We were enjoying ourselves so much.
Well, Mr. Spigot, need I point out to you where your deficiency lies as regards landing the role?
Yes, I think you ought to.
Need I say with overmuch emphasis that it is in the leg division that you are deficient?
The leg division?
The leg division, Mr. Spigot.
The leg division.
The leg division. You are deficient in it to the tune of one. Your right leg, I like. I like your right leg. It's a lovely leg for the role. That's what I said when I saw it come in. I said, lovely leg for the role. Lovely leg for the role. I've got nothing against your right leg. The trouble is, neither of you.
While Pete and Dud took their TV show not only but also to the mainstream, the satirical fire they had started was fanned by other performers at venues such as the Establishment Club, which was owned by Cook. A satire boom was to follow.
It's no accident that when Peter founded the Establishment Club, that the sort of jokes that went on there, they were related to the sort of jokes that we had expressed in Beyond the Fringe. And there was a series of people who was, there were overlapping personnel. It was also common with what was expressed in private eye as well. It was part of something which was much more self-consciously satirical. It undertook satire much more deliberately than we had undertaken satire.
Satire itself trickled into the mainstream, including Mike Yarwood's impressions and the ITV puppet show Spitting Image. And you could probably name 20 current TV shows that would call themselves satirical today. But back in the early 60s, the big guns were beyond the fringe and, following in 1962, that was the week that was.
That was the week that was, it's over, let it go. That was the week that was, it started way above par, finished way below.
From the moment in 1956 that John Osborne wrote Look Back in Anger and the Suez battle, Suez invasion indeed, took place, a show like That Was the Week That was really needed.
TW3 host David Frost.
People were finding the conservative regime after 10 or 12 years or whatever, that it was going back over the old ground and so on, and they were saying that they were sort of our elders and betters and so on, and the young people like us were really impatient for a change.
We had been brought up as a generation to respect our elders, to accept what we were doing, to do as we were told, to go to bed when we were told, to get up when we were told, to work when we were told.
Showbiz agent Laurie Mansfield.
And along came this programme that sort of said, no, 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 no. These are people. They are just people. You can take the mickey out of them. You can send them up in such a way. They have feet of clay like all of us. They are human beings. That was the week that was, broke all those taboos. It opened up all of those doors to say comedy should be about everybody, not just the working class. And there was this feeling at that time that we weren't allowed to laugh in this way. And God bless it, it was a breath of fresh air.
Hello, Steve here.
It's Brenda.
Ah, well, Steve's not here. This is Norm.
It sounded like Steve.
Yes, well, he left a message.
What did it say?
Go out and get some taffeta lace. It's a goodbye.
Goodbye?
Goodbye.
That was the week that was. It's over.
I think one of the great differences between comedy then and comedy now was the opportunity to be really topical in fiction, in plays and comedies.
TW3 writer David Nobbs.
Nowadays, all the topicality has to come in Have I Got News For You and that sort of show, of which there are many. But this is the only place you can really do it now. I remember once with my friend Peter Tinniswood, we wrote a sketch on a Saturday morning, delivered it by taxi, went down to White Hart Lane, saw Tottenham win, and went to the pub, had a few drinks, sauntered home and watched the sketch on that show that night. For us, that was exciting and gave us a kick you don't get now. But from the point of view of transmission, you can't do it because the piece is not topical that by the time they've recorded it, 11 executives have looked at it to see if it's got naughty words in it, etc. And it finally goes out. It doesn't mean anything.
After TW3, David Frost moved on to The Frost Report, a show that gave a leg up to an extraordinary range of people who would go on to become household names.
One of the real thrills of it was the writers we were able to bring together. We had all the five British members of Monty Python were writing for us. John Cleese was also performing for us and so on. And then we had other writers from other shows. We had the Goodies. We had a fantastic lineup of writers on the show. Marty Feldman was writing on the show. And across the board, we had a great lineup, and the sessions, the weekly script sessions, where everyone was in the room reading their stuff and listening to other people reading their stuff, it was a delight.
Decades before most independent production companies were formed, Frost set up his own organisation to look after his stable of performers. Not only the two Ronnies, but also a second groundbreaking group of Oxbridge comedians. John Cleese and Graham Chapman had appeared in the Frost-backed sketch series At Last, the 1948 show, while another of his productions, Do Not Adjust Your Set, featured Michael Palin, Eric Idle, and Terry Jones.
Mike and I had just done the Complete and Utter Histories, and we were recording the last series of Do Not Adjust Your Set. Suddenly the telephone goes, and it's John Cleese suggesting that we might like to do a show together. And so we grabbed at it and said, oh yes, and can our friend Eric Idle and Terry Gilliam, can they come along as well?
I think we felt we wanted to do something in which we had control. We could take all the risks ourselves.
Michael Palin.
We didn't know what it was we wanted to do, but we approached the BBC via Barry Took, and he said he'd talk to a man at the BBC who would in turn talk to us. We had a meeting at the BBC, and Michael Mills came in and said, what do you want to do? And we said, well, we'd like to do, shows. What sort of thing do you want to do? Well, not exactly sure what sort of thing, comedy and that. He said, right, 13 shows. Went straight out of the door. Couldn't understand it.
Trouble at Mill.
Oh, no. What kind of trouble?
I don't know. Mr. Wentworth told me to come and say there was trouble at the Mill, that's all. I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition.
No one expects a Spanish Inquisition. Our weapon is supplies. Supplies and fear. Fear and supplies are two weapons. Our fear and supplies and the ruthless efficiency are three weapons. Our fear and supplies and the ruthless efficiency and an almost fanatical devotion to the Pope. Amongst our weapons are fear, supplies, ruth. Amongst our weaponry are such elements as a fear. I'll come in again.
But what have the Monty Python team ever done for British comedy? Here's comedy writer and Python fan, Dennis Norden.
We'd been writing sketches and pastiche and all that kind of thing, and not only did you have to have sort of a little idea, but you had to have this thing called the payoff, the punchline, and you could spend like a whole morning writing the basic sketch and then 2 days searching for a payoff. Along comes Monty Python, who put on stuff where you get to a certain point and somebody comes on and says, and now for something completely different. And we, you know, sort of stomped on our typewriters we had at that time, bewailing the hours we'd spent looking for the logical finish to something, and these chaps made it possible to dispense with that, and we thought of all the moments we could have had at home with our loved ones.
Python comedy was edgy and often challenged the establishment. Sometimes, of course, the establishment calls your bluff.
I bet you they won't play this song on the radio. I bet you they won't play this new song. It's not that it's or controversial, just that the ing words are awfully strong.
And now for something completely different. Fired by Tony Hancock earlier in the decade, writers Ray Galton and Alan Simpson were offered their own TV slot in 1962. The Galton and Simpson Playhouse was a series of half-hour comedies, some of which would stand alone, while others would be considered as pilots for possible sitcoms. It's a format that survives to the present day, and it's given us some of the best-remembered British sitcoms. More of those later. First, here are Alan Simpson and Ray Galton.
After number four, we dried up. We couldn't think of a subject. And we sat with about 3 days having, you know, and then one morning, Ray said, we had a little thing that we used to do. We used to, say two impossible things, two things just to make ourselves laugh. You know, like two rat catchers, things you wouldn't. Anyway, Ray one morning said, two rag and bone men. And I thought he was carrying on with the. Jokes. Didn't think he was serious. And so I didn't say anything. And about two or three hours later, and I thought, oh, no, that's quite bizarre. And I said to him, what about those two rack and bone men? He said, what about me? He thought that I'd turned it down. And we were running out of time, so we said, well, look, we've got to start. So we started writing. We didn't know who they were, what their relationship was. We just started writing first Rag and Bone Man and second Rag and Bone Man. and we had one of them coming in off the round and having a row about the stuff that was on the cart. We then carried on. We got the idea of how to finish it, you know, the fact that he was going to leave the business, and so the old man said, well, you go and leave. You're not taking the horse, though. He's mine.
I don't want to borrow him. I got my stuff moved up.
No, you've never liked him, have you? You've never had a good word to say for him all the time we've had him.
But God have the horse, otherwise I'm going to move my stuff up.
That's your problem, isn't it? You're not having a horse.
Well, keep your rotten, stinking horse. Don't bother me, mate. I'll move it on my own. I never got nothing in the past from you, so don't do me no favours. I don't want none now.
Is that Breakup?
Yeah.
I'll go and open the gate, shall I?
Oh. Oh, you rotten, stinking cop! I can't go. I can't get away.
Good comedy has always reflected that which it is facing.
Media lecturer Dr. C.P. Lee.
Johnny Spate is there in the pantheon along with Galton and Simpson in recognising what's around him and being able to make that funny. So bigotry is held up to be a pomposity that needs to be pricked, in the same way that Hancock's actor-manager figure, who's very much a figure of the past, is also there to be pricked.
Steptoe and Son took comedy seriously. It cast actors rather than performers known purely for comedy and told stories of depth and pathos. Broadcaster and comedy writer Dennis Norden.
I'm not going to overpraise Alan and Ray because they're mates of mine. I'll simply say this, that when my daughter was taking her A-levels, Harold Pinter was set as a play, and when she told me about it and I went to the parents' evening, I said to one of the teachers, if the intention is to show demotic speech with its pauses and its occasional flashes of poetry, I think better than that you could have chosen practically any script of Steptoe and Son.
Following its initial 1960s run, Steptoe and Son returned in the 70s, when the team set themselves a new challenge to make it the funniest thing they'd ever written.
You frustrate me in everything I try to do. You are a dyed-in-the-wool, fascist, reactionary, squalid little know-your-place, don't rise above yourself, don't get out of your hole, complacent little turd. You haven't finished yet. You are morally, spiritually and physically a festering, fly-blown heap of accumulated filth.
What do you want for your tea?
You're listening to A History of British Comedy on BBC Radio 2. I'm David Mitchell.
Hello.
The 1970s have been called a golden age for British TV sitcom. Well, that all depends on your point of view.
I don't think there's any truly golden age in comedy terms.
Laurie Mansfield.
I think there are times when comedy, like music, moves in its fashions and in its styles, and depending on what your comedy taste is, each generation has and should have its own version of what they consider to be a golden age of comedy. In terms of domestic family entertainment that was family in the sense the family sat and watched, the 70s probably was a golden age because we all knew our place. There weren't the number of channels that we've got now, and it had to please as many people as possible in as short a space of time. That doesn't exist today, and neither should it.
I am known for two very successful shows.
Comedy writer David Nobbs.
I have done other much less successful shows, and I am not known for them. People only remember the good ones. It's the exact opposite of a politician, where his one gaffe haunts him for the rest of his life. People remember the great shows of those eras, and they don't remember some absolute stinkers. So I don't think in that sense there was a golden age. What I do think was that there were more great moments. And I think this is tied in irrevocably with the changing face of our media. Today, people don't watch the same show in large numbers like they used to. They don't discuss them the next day at work because they've all watched different things.
Whatever the reason, the spiky anger of 1960s satire was giving way to a lighter touch. The 70s saw a blossoming of comic family viewing, Rising Damp, Fawlty Towers, Man About the House, Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads, and many more.
I've been very careful about my diet. I've been told I look like Kelly Nastasi.
Who?
Nastasi, the tennis player, Wimbledon.
Tennis.
I like tennis. I've joined the Rockcliffe Club.
God preserve us.
I saw your mother the other day. She looked very well.
Oh, aye.
Not to speak too, like, just through the car window.
Through the what?
The car window.
What car window?
My car window.
You've got a car?
I haven't just got the window.
We weren't watching much television, but we were going avidly to the movies.
Series writers Ian Lefrenet and Dick Clement.
And we were very enthusiastic about those 60s movies, which were basically working-class movies. They were a new kind of hero. And then the drama on television, which started to change things, which was Z Cars. And so out of this mix, we kind of wanted to create people who really belonged in those genres, but then we wanted to give them some jokes.
At the time, most situation comedy cast comedians in the leads. And, of course, we didn't. We cast two actors in the leads. And that immediately kept it grounded in something closer to reality.
Have they had crabs?
No. No, I don't eat seafood.
Lice?
No.
VD?
No.
Suffer from any illness?
Bad feet.
Suffer from any illness?
Bad feet.
Made a recent visit to a doctor or hospital?
Only when me bad feet.
Are you now, or have you at any time, been a practicing homosexual?
What were these feet?
The character of Fletcher in Porridge was already built into the script. There was nothing you needed to do, you just picked it up and did it.
Comedy legend, Ronnie Barker.
Thanks to the wonderful writing of Dick Clement and Ian Lefrenet.
Porridge came from the same comedy playhouse-type format which had launched Steptoe & Son back in the early 60s. Other much-loved comedy shows that have sprung from the pilot series format include Open All Hours, Last of the Summer Wine, and Are You Being Served?
At least you're here on time, Mrs. Slocum.
Time for what? There won't be any customers, you know. And what is doing to my domestic arrangements? Having a bath at 6 o'clock in the morning played havoc with my pussy.
Unlike their American counterparts, most British sitcoms are written by one or two original creators rather than by teams. And although not everyone recognises the names of David Croft and Jimmy Perry, Ronald Chesney and Ronald Wolfe, or Eric Chappell, it was their vision that gave us Dad's Army, On the Buses and Rising Damp.
Americans sit round a table and discuss it and contribute and possibly even write bits of it like that. I mean, I'm not sure of the exact process.
Comedy writer David Nobbs, the man behind the timeless Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin.
Good God.
You know what those are?
Rifles? Who on earth are these for, Jimmy?
Army equipped to fight for Britain when the balloon goes up.
What army? What balloon? Up what? Fight against whom? Come on, Jimmy. Who are you going to fight against when this balloon of yours goes up?
Forces of anarchy, wreckers of law and order.
Ah, I see.
Communists, Maoists, Trotskyists, neo-Trotskyists, crypto-Trotskyists, union leaders, communist union leaders.
I see.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans, football supporters, namby-pamby probation officers, rapists, papists, papist rapists.
I see.
Foreign Surgeons, Wedgwood Ben, Keg Bitter, Punk Rock, Glue Sniffers, Play for Today, Squatters, Clive Jenkins, Roy Jenkins, Up Jenkins, Up Everybody's, Chinese Restaurants. Why do you think Windsor Castle is ringed with Chinese restaurants?
Is that all?
Yes.
I see.
We tend to have one, or at most two, lonely, antisocial writers who live in caves and caravans and windmills and things somewhere in the country and write their strange stuff about their strange view of the world.
You realise the sort of people you're going to attract, don't you, Jimmy? Thugs, bully boys, psychopaths, sack policemen, security guards, sack security guards, racialists, queer bashers, chin bashers, fascia bashers, anybody bashers, rear admirals, queer admirals, vice admirals, fascists, neo-fascists, crypto-fascists, loyalists, neo-loyalists, crypto-loyalists.
You really think so? I thought support might be difficult.
Carla Lane, the woman behind the Liverbirds, Bread and Butterflies.
I've been to America. The idea was that I would write comedy, but I was given about 7 or 8 other funny writers, and I found them a great intrusion. I honestly think that most of the comedies which have been really heartwarming have come from a single writer.
Have you finished your hat yet?
Nah.
You've been at it for 3 months. They'll have gone out of fashion.
Gone out of fashion? There never has been a hat like this.
If I were you, I'd knit another one. Then you'll have a pair of bed socks.
But any minute now, some anger was about to storm back in. The particular car-thrashing, goose-stepping, Spaniard-abusing anger of a frustrated Devon Hotelier, played by one of the show's writers.
Good morning, madam. Can I help you?
Are you the manager?
I am the owner, madam.
What?
I am the owner.
I want to speak to the manager.
I am the manager, too.
What?
I am the manager as well.
Manager, he manager.
You're what?
I'm the manager.
What?
I'm the manager.
Yes, I know. You've just told me. What's the matter with you? Now, listen to me. I booked a room with a bath. When I book a room with a bath, I expect to get a bath.
You've got a bath.
I'm not paying £7.20 per night plus VAT for a room without
there
a bath.
Where is your bath?
You call that a bath? It's not big enough to drown a mouse. It's disgraceful.
I wish you were a mouse, I'm sure.
Fawlty Towers still tops the polls for favourite sitcom today and is cited as an influence by comedy writers, even though the truth is no writer ever seriously expects to touch it. Fawlty Towers is the gold standard.
We spent about 6 weeks each on those half-hour scripts, which is unheard of.
Co-writer and lead, John Cleese.
And I don't think we started writing the dialogue for at least 3 weeks. We just ran the story again and again. We told each other the story again and again and again until we sort of flattened out the bumps.
I asked for a room with a view.
Deaf, mad and blind. This is the view as far as I can remember, madam. Yes, yes, this is it.
When I pay for a view, I expect something more interesting than that.
That is Torquay, madam.
But it's not good enough.
Well, may I ask what you were expecting to see out of a Torquay hotel bedroom window? Sydney Opera House, perhaps? The Hanging Gardens of Babylon? Herds of wildebeest sweeping majestically?
Don't be silly. I expect to be able to see the sea.
You can see the sea. It's over there between the land and the sky.
It was unique insofar as they were farces. They were immaculately constructed by John and Connie Booth.
Barry Cryer.
They were real playlets. They weren't your average sitcom. And what I did admire was, of course, when they'd done a couple of series and whatever, they said, that's it, leave it.
As it became normal over the course of the 1970s for there to be a TV set in every household, careers blossomed for a host of variety performers, with sketch shows from Dave Allen, Dick Emery and Stanley Baxter, and magic shows from a certain character comedian.
Well, good evening. have I got time for more?
He was really so completely, naturally funny.
Ronnie Corbett.
And he couldn't explain it, and that really was part of the funniness. The surprise on his face as he walked into anywhere, people laughed at him, and he couldn't really believe what they were laughing at, because it was so simple for him.
No, I lost my voice a bit as I went and saw a doctor. And he said, he looked at me, Mum. I went like that. And he looked down, he's a little raw. I went, it wasn't loud, it was.
Like Benny Hill, Tommy Cooper was a big star for ITV. However, in the 1970s, most of the top-rated comedy was on BBC One. Under the then head of Light Entertainment, Bill Cotton, the BBC made room for an unprecedented array of comic talent.
This is BBC One, in colour.
Shut that door.
Are you the gentleman in charge of this test centre?
I am. Can I help you?
I've heard that there's one of your examiners who won't pass a woman driver unless she lets him have his way with her.
Well, I don't know whether it's true or not, miss, but if you can point him out to me, I'll have him.
No, you point him out to me, and I'll have him.
What a silly Billy.
The 1970s for the BBC, and in a term for what we now call the television host show, were the halcyon days of British television, and the BBC had them all.
Theatrical agent Laurie Mansfield.
Saturday nights on the BBC was just a must, and the lineup of entertainers, the Bill Cotton, bought into the BBC and sustained through that period and stuck by in many cases to enable them to grow and to develop, is alike we'll never see again. It was never ending. They just had series after series after series that the public turned to and expected. And it was a great tribute to Bill Cotton, to the BBC and to those entertainers that they controlled Light Entertainment in a manner that ITV just could not compete with.
And up there in that top rank, the two Ronnies. Barker and Corbett first worked together on The Frost Report, where they performed alongside John Cleese in the famous class sketch, which so profoundly wouldn't work on radio that here's something else.
And so to our first contender. Good evening, your name please.
Good evening.
Your first heat, your chosen subject was answering questions before they were asked. This time, you have chosen to answer the question before last each time. Is that correct?
Charlie Smithers.
The two Ronnies were great for all sorts of reasons. One, they were both brilliant actors. Ronnie Barker, the more gifted actor. Ronnie Corbett, the more gifted comedian.
Two Ronnies writer, David Nobbs.
Ronnie Corbett with the best sense of timing that I've ever known. Ronnie Barker with the what only Leonard Rossiter have I met, as fluent in words, as able to do tongue twisters brilliantly, you know. They're phenomenal talents for us, and very varied. Look different, sound different. And then all you need, really, is good writing.
And your time starts now. What is paleontology?
Yes, absolutely correct.
What's the name of the directory that lists members of the peerage?
A study of old fossils.
Who are Len Murray and Sir Geoffrey Howe?
Burks.
Correct. What is the difference between a donkey and an ass?
One's a trade union leader, the other's a member of the cabinet.
I mean, I was probably, I don't know, I was probably about 37, you see, by the time The Frost Report, which was my television break, at 37. Now people get television breaks at 18, 19, and 21, don't they?
Ronnie Corbett.
And Ronnie, similar age, a little bit older than me, only a year. So we were kind of old hands at performing in front of people with all our theatrical and nightclub experience. And the key moment in our lives was supposed to be this wonderful moment where Ron and I, on behalf of London Weekend Television, were hosting BAFTAs or some similar award thing at the Palladium. And there was a technical breakdown, and we had to sort of fill the gap, and we're supposed to have done it so well that I can't remember doing it that well. But Paul Fox had turned to Bill Cotton, sitting next to him, and said, can we get these two, do you think, for the BBC? And they tried to and did, and so we moved from, and that was it.
Many people have called the two Ronnies a double act, But like Mel Smith and Griffiths Jones, or Alexander Armstrong and Ben Miller, they weren't the traditional sort of double act in the sense of never working apart. Also, there wasn't a straight man. On both these counts, they differed from Little and Large, Cannon and Ball, and those ones who did Bring Me Sunshine.
We get along
not now.
We get along
not now.
You'll tell me when?
Now.
Pardon?
We get along so easily, don't you agree? We like each other's company, don't you agree?
I cannot analyse the success of Morecambe and Wise because it grew over a period of time through their ATV series, when frankly in that time they were a British double act who were very successful, to their time at the BBC when they became part of the fabric of British society.
Show business agent Laurie Mansfield.
They were much loved. I think if you're a comedian or you do comedy and the audience love you, you are on a different plateau to every other form of comedy. You are forgiven whether it is funny or not funny because you are Eric Morecambe or you are Ernie Wise. And they had that. They brought to television wit, style, a degree of elegance, a reality. They were the perfect double act. They were the people you wanted to be with.
When did you last see a woman?
I've forgotten, sir.
It's no good trying to fight me. Your little heart is pounding like a whippet in a bowler hat.
But you're in love with Mark Antony.
Me? And Mark Antony?
Yes!
Don't mention that man's name to me. I can't stand the sight of him.
Yeah, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I heard that. I'm Mark Antony. Now listen to me. It's time for me to act.
That'll be the day.
Here's Eric Morecambe in discussion with writer and comedy producer Mike Craig back in the 1970s.
On Ernie's instigation, we started with radio up in Manchester, doing, for Ronnie Taylor, doing a variety fanfare, which was a similar thing to Variety Bandbox, only I always thought it was better, because we were in it. And we must have done about 10 or 12 of those. And then they asked us, you know, we started off first comics,
yes.
You know, second comics, third comics, and really the top of the bill then. And we started off very nicely, and that was the big break for us, to get in on radio.
Yeah.
Although it was only Northern Home Service in those days.
I think we shared it. I was very much the song and dance man. Eric was very much the comedian.
The moment we've all been waiting for, Ernie Wise.
I think we had an edge on all the people in the fact that we could move well. Eric and I were reasonably good dancers. We could bluff it. We believed it. We came down and we were Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers or all these people. And we did. We could kid the people that we were that good.
Morecambe and Wise seemed, and still seem today, universally loved by fellow comics as well as the audience. Like Laurel and Hardy, you'd be hard-pushed to find a comedy writer or performer alive today who doesn't recognise their genius.
One of the memories of me and my dad watching Morecambe and Wise.
Comedian Dave Spikey.
And, yeah, just me and my dad laughing so hard. You know, when you laugh so hard you can't breathe. It's, for some reason, you slide down the chair. I don't know why, you're gasping for it. You're going, and you're just ending up sort of half on the floor, laughing so much. Eric Morecambe was, again, genius, but instinctive genius. It was his looks, and comedy's all about that. It's all about the head. It's all about the eyes and the sides and the pulling the face and all that. And he got everything. He got that in spades. And, you know, you see comedians now in arenas, and I'm thinking, but surely half the comedy is in the eyes and the face. How can you... You know, and... But he was.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight, Grieg's Piano Concerto by Grieg. Soloist, Mr. Eric Morecambe, conducted by Mr. André Frey. Thank you.
I would think the closest we ever got to perfection, because we always tried for it, you never get it, the closest we ever got, I suppose, is the Grieg Piano Concerto with André Previn.
The man what wrote most of their stuff, Eddie Graeber.
Ha ha ha!
So they're all the violins?
We could spend the rest of the series summing up the contribution Morecambe and Wise made to British comedy. Let's just say that 30 years since they last made a new show, they are still as much a part of a British Christmas as turkey, tinsel, and finding your relatives unbearable.
Arsenal.
Where do you want to go?
Where is it?
Eh?
That's off.
Do you want some music off?
Be a bad idea. Can we have any music off?
Is it possible?
Is it possible to have a little bit of music off? You know.
Oh, fine, that's fine. I thought you were looking after my coat.
Although TV and radio dominated in the 70s, live variety shows still packed out theatres in every seaside town. Meanwhile, stand-up comedians who would have toured the inland variety circuit a few years earlier were now performing in working men's clubs. Stand-ups such as Jimmy Tarbuck, Bob Monkhouse and Les Dawson.
Oh, I love that applause. To me, applause is like love, and I really enjoyed that. But be honest, folks, while you were doing that, were you closing your eyes and thinking of another comedian? As I don't need that sort of humiliation. I really think I'm serious about this because I've had a lot of trouble ever since I arrived here tonight. There was the usual big crowd outside the stage door and the shout went up, "Here's Bob Monkhouse!" And everyone stared at me. I was so embarrassed. I wished I hadn't shouted.
Good evening.
I went to the doctor last week. I said, "Can I have some sleeping pills for the wife?" He said, "Why?" I said, "She woke up." My wife is a very beautiful woman with a very interesting left eye. The right one keeps looking at it. You see, I haven't spoken to the wife for 5 years. It's not that we've had a row, it's just I'm not quick enough to interrupt.
Les Dawson was famed for his mother-in-law routines. The idea of a married couple living with their in-laws might seem strange now, but in the 70s it was common. Most comedy, although the greatest of it can remain funny for a long period of time, is rooted in the habits and principles of its own era.
Please forgive me if I appear down in the mouth this evening, but I've just had some bad news. Tomorrow it's the mother-in-law's funeral, and she's cancelled it.
I mean, nobody could take the remarks, surely. Seriously. Well, I used to say that she was a decoy for a whaling fleet. And the skin stretched to such an extent when she bends her knees, her eyelids fly open. I mean, come on, that's so extensionist. It's ridiculous to even believe that it's been derogative. I mean, this is a cartoon, Kessel Lampoon. It's basically an affection anyway. I mean, I don't pull anything to pieces that I don't like. Things I don't like, I ignore. Things I'm fond of, I make fun of.
I haven't seen her for about a fortnight. It's a fortnight ago. I was in a public house with dubious distinction. I can imagine how I felt. There she was, lying on the floor of the 4 Ale Bar in a pool of spilt Britvic and chewed cashew nuts. And six men from an oil rig were hitting her with bar stools. One of my neighbours said he'd got to help. I said, no, six of them should be enough.
The stand-up comic had always been a part of the traditional variety bill, of course. But that would change when someone dared to suggest that a TV show could succeed by featuring stand-up comedy and nothing else. Here's the man behind The Comedians, producer Johnny Hamp.
I think it took a southerner to see what was going on in the clubs around Manchester and in the north, and I used to go usually to see the top of the bill, but I noticed that there was always a stand-up comic or a compare comic, and that some of them I thought were terrific, you know, very, very funny and so much different from the guys that were touring the variety halls and doing a 6-minute spot. And I thought what I'd do is get about 30 of them in and do 10 minutes each, and they just did 10 minutes. I took the tapes away and edited up what was the first comedian show. But of course, everyone, Lou Grade, I remember saying to me, "You, where's your stars? Where's your Max Bygraves? Where's your Des O'Connor? You know, this will never work."
Do you know if you find the edge of a 50 pence piece, you can use it as 10p?
What it did do, I think, was lead to what we have today. I mean, shows entirely composed of stand-up comics. Admittedly, these days they do perhaps longer routines than we did on The Comedians. They were just stand-up jokes, and you might get 30, 40 gags in, or perhaps even more, in half an hour.
The world of the traditional stand-up would change later in the decade as patter and gag routines became less fashionable than the political or observational style that we're more familiar with today. More of that in the next programme, when we take our story into a new decade, the 1980s, where political correctness and social awareness would come to the fore. Join me next time for the final part of Radio 2's journey through the last 100 years of British comedy, as we bring our story up to the present and see that the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Okie kookie, pig in a pookie!
This time next year, we'll be millionaires.
You're trying to be funny! Because if you are, I think it's in pretty poor taste, that's all. I'm not a fridge, you know!
Yes, Minister.
You've been listening to Radio 2's History of British Comedy. It was presented by me, David Mitchell. It was written and produced by Phil Collinge, and the executive producer was Ashley Byrne. It was a Made in Manchester production for BBC Radio 2.
I'm above it.
Online, on digital radio, and on 88 to 91 FM, this is Radio 2 from the BBC.